You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, we will remember longtime Sioux City weatherman Tom Peterson, who has a new black box theater named after him at the Sioux City Community Theater. And we'll find out how to save precious family photos after they've been drenched by floodwaters. But first, we'll take a look at the upcoming 2020 caucuses. This year, for the first time, you can take part without even showing up. State Democrats say people can caucus virtually during the week that leads up to the February 3rd event. Seth Cohen is in charge of the Iowa caucuses for the State Democratic Party. Cohen says the changes, which await final approval, are historic.
They're really the biggest changes we've seen to the caucus process since they were created in 1972. And I think it's also representative of the time. You know, it helps move the caucus process into the 21st century. So there are some major points that are going to allow us to really make this very, very transparent and very accessible to Iowans who want to be part of the Democratic nominating process next year. And there, you know, so some of the changes I'd like to, wanted to highlight are the virtual caucus, which is going to be over a couple of days prior to the actual caucus, and then on the night of the caucus as well, on the in-person caucus, precinct caucuses. We will be having people who can call in through their phones, and they can give their preference and be a part of the process. To people who may be disabled or have children who are working at night, it allows them to participate in this caucus for the first time, which is great to open it up to a lot of to more and more people. We've streamlined the realignment process, which is going to take a lot of the gamesmanship out of what the caucuses used to be.
Maybe people don't know what that means. You talk about realignment.
So after you give your first state of preference, if depending on how many delegates your individual caucus is electing that night, that'll change the percentage of people who are going to be elected to the county and then ultimately up to the district and state conventions. And so based on whatever the number of people who show up, there's a certain threshold you have to hit to be considered viable in that precinct. And if your group is not viable, then you will either need to realign into uncommitted or align with another candidate's team to move forward into the second round of alignment.
Why was that changed? I mean, it's been that way for quite a long time, right? The way it was.
Yes. Yeah, so I think transparency is a big piece of it. So when it can create some contention, especially maybe with newer caucusers or people who might be a little more unfamiliar with the rules, it allows you to for people to make it as contentious. And it's a more fair process. If I understand the rules better than Group B, I can try to manipulate the system to benefit my candidate the best, and it can create some animosity towards those groups. And I think it's a better way for the system to work.
You know, there was on here, it was talking about the recounts and how the recounts would work.
So as of right now, the recounts are going to be working in a way that a candidate can ask for either a recount or a canvass by congressional district or statewide. And they have to provide a reason for what they think may have gone wrong on caucus night. And so we have put in a process that will allow us to see not only what the final result is on caucus night, but you'll see when the first alignment, the second alignment, and what the state delegate equivalent is for these campaigns, and allow us to be more transparent so you can actually see the movement of bodies as the realignment process happens.
I know that the Democratic Party, I believe it was last summer, had a lot of meetings and talked about how the caucus system should go forward. And I heard some people saying, well, do we really need the caucus system? In Nebraska, they got rid of doing caucuses. But it sounds like the Iowa caucuses are such a tradition and something that people across the country every year, I think, look forward to seeing. They kind of look forward to seeing the coverage of it on TV.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And I think that with the what we've adapted to what changes people are looking to be made and really getting with this telecaucus, I think allows us to, again, bring the caucuses into the 21st century and allows us to be successful and transparent and open.
I read that there was a public comment period about these rules. Is that over now?
Yeah, I believe that it was a 30-day period from when the plan came out. We've had hundreds of hours of conversations with folks all across the country. And so we are really excited about the input that the public has been giving us to make this, again, transparent and accessible to all Democratic Iowans.
But this hasn't been finalized yet, is that right? These changes haven't been finalized?
No, it still needs to be approved by the State Central Committee and then the Rules and Bylaws Committee of the DNC. No, I think that these changes are phenomenal. Having worked as a staffer on Democratic caucus campaigns, having been a participant of Democratic caucus campaigns, we are really excited about what these changes are going to bring to the state and to the process. And it will allow us to be at the forefront of the presidential nominating process for years to come. It's great to be part of the process. I think the best thing we can do is make sure we have our best caucus yet. We're gonna see a lot of people come out. We're seeing a lot of excitement. And to have this great new way for more and more people to participate is going to be a great thing.
That was Seth Cohen, the caucus convention director for the Iowa Democratic Party. The 2020 caucuses take place February 3rd. However, beginning this year, Iowans can caucus online before the event. There are also new rules about delegate selection. The party hopes will make the caucuses more transparent and fair to everyone involved. Over the weekend, several Democrats who are running for president in 2020 and who will be involved in the caucuses visited Buena Vista University in Storm Lake to take part in a discussion of rural issues called the Heartland Forum. As Katie Pikus reports, the event allowed them to connect with rural voters, which Democrats say is key to the party winning in 2020.
There are 15 Democrats who have officially announced that they are running for president in 2020. Saturday at Storm Lake's Buena Vista University, four of them took the stage. They give their vision for rural America, and they answer questions from the Storm Lake Times, HuffPost, and audience members. A common theme is agriculture. In her opening statement, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts says family farms and small farms are getting squeezed by giant corporations. But Warren says there's one way to stop it: enforcing antitrust laws that ensure a fair playing field in the market. She wants to break up agribusinesses.
And break up so that they not only don't have that kind of economic power, so that they're wiping out competition, so they're taking all the profits for themselves and making it unsustainable for our farms, but also break up so they don't have that kind of political power.
Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota is the ranking member of the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee. In her opening statement, she says corporate control is an issue she has seen all over the country, but it's prominent in agriculture.
When we're in a situation where 78% of the seed for our farmers is controlled by two companies, and our railroads now for Class 1 are down to 4, the same number as on the monopoly board, I think we are now entering what is essentially a new Gilded Age, and we need to take on the power of these monopolies.
A member of the audience asks former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro about the policies he would promote to support food farming and make the country more resilient. Castro says the country should be looking out for small farms, what's happening on the production chain, and the effects on small businesses.
I think that, you know, the Department of Agriculture and the Small Business Administration have a tremendous role to play in helping to ensure that small businesses, including family farms, are well capitalized and pursuing policy that helps them get there. Right?
A day before the forum, former Maryland Congressman John Delaney announced his Heartland Fair deal, a deal he says would improve conditions in rural America. He tells the crowd he wants to create an antitrust framework that he says would make sense for the country.
So a big centerpiece of my Heartland Fair deal is to actually do things to make sure capital is flowing to rural America, because that's really what's happened to rural America in the last several decades, in my judgment. Capital has left this region.
Jim Eliason of Storm Lake says he liked what he heard from the candidates. He dons a navy blue hat that says Make America Think Again. He says he wants the hat to send a message to fellow rural voters.
I think that that in general, people thinking about politics need to think harder and think in a more nuanced fashion, rather than simply accepting things at face value. So it's partly a plea for critical thinking about political things.
Democratic Party leaders say one of the keys to winning in 2020 will be connecting with voters in rural America.
They need to show up, and they are.
Jan Norris is from Red Oak in southwest Iowa. She says she also liked what she heard at the forum. She already feels like the candidates are connecting and has some advice.
They need to hear us. They need to feel us. And they just, yeah, they just can't fly over us. They've got to care about us.
Art Cullen, the editor of the Storm Lake Times and one of the hosts of the forum, says he believes candidates are reaching out to rural Americans and that the 2020 presidential race will be won or lost in the Midwest.
That was Katie Pikus reporting from Buena Vista University in Storm Lake. She was at the Heartland Forum over the weekend. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Many Siouxlanders experienced flooding over the last few weeks. Even a little water in the basement can damage precious photos and family mementos. Often it's hard to know what to do to salvage them. However, Randy Silverman, the head of preservation at the University of Utah Marriott Library, says there are a few simple steps that can save your mom's baby pictures and yearbooks from oblivion. He says it's a matter of getting to the photos while they're still wet.
It's the most important thing to many families. The box of family photos contains the heirloom images of the family tree, and it's so important for people to be able to save them. The problem with photographs is a photographic image is essentially silver that's embedded in gelatin, which is glue, animal glue. And when the photographs get wet, either the negatives or the prints, the gelatin softens, and then as soon as they dry out, the gelatin starts to harden. And we call it blocking. And once they start to block, you can't undo it without tearing the photograph. It's not reversible by getting them wet again. And the drying out happens within, say, 24 hours, sometimes much less. And so the priority is to figure out what your prized possessions are, and if they're the photographs, immediately find those and try and separate them. And it's easy to save them once you've figured this out. It's really simple. You just have to peel them apart and set them out to dry on a flat surface image up, and they'll dry. It's a little better if you want to put paper underneath it. It could be paper towels or even newspaper, because the water in the photos will be blotted by the paper and be pulled away from the photo on the bottom, and on the top, the air will evaporate the water out of them. And the trick is first to prioritize and figure out that the photos are essential, and then to create good airflow. So once we've started to separate them, turning on the fans and opening up the windows will speed up evaporation, and it also helps to reduce the risk of mold. And mold is going to start within 3 days, and everything gets worse after the mold starts. So moving the air around is the priority as well.
When we talk about things like yearbooks, you had some advice I'd never heard of about how to preserve those.
Yearbooks are similar to photographs in that they're printed on slick paper, and that slickness is a coating. And the coating is adhesive in some cases. Not every slick paper is an adhesive-coated paper, but a lot of them are. And yearbooks are especially notorious for printing on this slick surface. So again, when the pages get wet, they're all going to stick together as the book starts to dry out. So if you tear sheets of wax paper slightly larger than the size of the page and insert that sheet of wax paper all the way to the back fold, to the very, very back, and separate every page, as they dry out, the book will not stick together. The problem is, of course, now we've got a book full of wax paper, and trying to get the air to flow past that and cause evaporation is very tough. So putting books like that full of wax paper in front of fans or open windows, and stimulating the evaporation is essential, but they can be saved. And again, like the photographs, the yearbooks often contain memories, you know, the personal note from some teacher or some student that is really highly valued, and it's not replaceable. In every case, the irreplaceable components of our historic past are the things that we most cherish.
What about regular books? Say it's a book you really love, maybe it's a book that's worth a little money. What should you do with that?
So for regular books, if we stand them up on end and put them in front of fans, they'll dry out, and it depends how wet they were. If they were underwater, it might take 4 days. If it's just a little bit wet at the edges, and a lot of times when books get wet, they're not soaked all the way through. The book will dry out. If it's a mass market paperback, those are the little books from the grocery store. Those soak up water like a sponge, and those are really difficult to recover and have and look any good. But most books are published on good quality paper, and they'll evaporate out if the airflow can get to the back of the leaves. And that's, again, critical to prevent mold from occurring. So the regular papers are not going to stick together. Sometimes regular books have a little cluster of images that are printed on a slick paper, and those are going to stick together. So sometimes we have to search around in the book to be sure that there's not slick paper, and if there is, separate those pages with wax paper. And the problem with all of this drying that I'm going to describe today is it is not perfect. If we squeeze the books as they get dry, so after about 3 days, we put books like that in a press and we squeeze them hard overnight, and then we'll let them stand open again the next day and continue evaporating. Well, people don't have access to presses, so if you put it under some weight, it'll help minimize the cockling of the paper. But the paper will cockle, and those distortions are kind of normal for things that have gotten wet. And it's better to accept the idea right now that it will not be perfect, that we'll do our best to save it, but, you know, it may not come out perfectly.
When you talk about cockling, and they'll sort of curl.
Yes, they'll curl. The papers curl, and the photographs will curl naturally when they dry. Paper, what's happening with the paper is it's expanding when it gets wet, and then it shrinks, but not all the way when it dries. And often books get wet on the top and the front and the bottom, and not in the middle of the page. I've seen entire libraries that were flooded underwater, and when the water was pumped out, because they were standing on a shelf and the books expanded a little bit when the water started getting to them, you open the book and it's dry in the center of the page, and on any page. It was surprising. So they don't soak up water like a sponge, as you might think they would. The cheap papers do, but most books are just going to take in the water at the edges. And then those are physically larger when the book dries out than the center of the page. So it's natural for that cockling to occur. And there's not a whole lot we can do about that, excepting that it's going to be damaged as part of this.
What about clothes? Should we just put them in the washer, or if they need to be dry cleaned, take them to the dry cleaner?
The working clothes, the daily clothes, are generally just treated like laundry, and that's fine. And we can get rid of the staining if there was mud in the water by taking it to a dry cleaner. Not in every case, but a lot of it can be removed. With older material, like wedding dresses or, you know, historic christening gowns, really important textiles, it would be most appropriate to just try and dry it very carefully, because, in fact, it can't take the tumbling from dryers, and it the agitation in a washing machine will sometimes just tear the fabric. Once it's dry, if it's badly stained, it might be improved by taking it to a dry cleaner.
What other objects need protection or need to be refurbished after a flood?
There are lots of family heirlooms that we've not discussed. You know, the family Bible contains the records of the family's births and deaths and marriages. Certain jewelry has importance. Sometimes there's old furniture that we've inherited. So in each case, the material type has something to do with the nature of how well it's going to dry. A Bible, for instance, is a thick book, and it's not easy to stand it up on end. So just putting it in a place that's well ventilated, a room that gets lots of airflow, will help dry it, and then monitoring that by turning pages and trying to blot things with paper towels. Jewelry is mostly not going to be damaged by the water, so it will just dry out. It might have some mud on it, but that's easily removed. The furniture might crack. Some wooden objects, when they get wet, it's kind of a shock. The wood is swelling, and then as it shrinks quickly, it might crack. So we can slow that down a little bit, even though it's you want to move the furniture to that well-ventilated room, but you want to slow it down by wrapping it with saran wrap, you know, a cling wrap, and letting it not dry out all at once, and then take the cling wrap off every day so that some evaporation occurs, and you can use a little bit of some towels or paper towels to blot the water. And then, but slowing it down so maybe we dry it over the course of 3 weeks instead of dry it out in 4 days.
What about home decor, say like paintings, pieces of art?
If a painting got wet, it will dry out again, and it may be, you know, water damaged or mud damaged, but we can save the painting itself by just taking it off the wall and placing it on a horizontal surface like a table and lifting up the four corners with like a little plastic block at the corners and allowing the air to flow under it and over it. And in every case, it's possible that something of great value can be treated for by a conservator. The actual conservation treatment of objects is possible, but saving it is the critical thing. What we don't want to do is throw away our family heirlooms. So I'm busy trying to tell people, don't throw it out, dry it out.
That was Randy Silverman, the head of preservation at the University of Utah Marriott Library. He spoke to us from Salt Lake City on how to preserve family heirlooms, books, clothing, and furnishings after a flood. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. On Sunday, around 3,000 people gathered for a cultural tradition in Sioux City. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer was there and gave us a sample of the diversity on display.
The faces of Siouxland Multicultural Fair served up a melting pot of ideas, food, and entertainment at the Sioux City Convention Center. From Mexican dancers to a children's area with face painting and balloons. A chance for people of all backgrounds and ages to join together, including 10-year-old Rain and her 5-year-old friend Anna.
Everyone, like their nationality and their countries, come together.
There's a lot of things to do, and there's a lot of good things.
And what balloon do you have?
Melanie Arnold spent the afternoon with her husband and two kids.
Teddy is 3 and JP is 5.
Arnold enjoyed the energy of the event.
It's a lot of fun. I've never been before, and I learned about a lot of different organizations around the area that I didn't know existed.
One of the many organizations taking part, the Mary J. Tralia Community House.
We have immigration lawyer services. We have translation, English language learning. We have a preschool.
That's Molly Dalbaum, an English language learning instructor at Mary Tralia. She also brought her family along to experience this mixture of cultures.
I really love the performances. Jalisco dancers with their bright, bright Mexican skirts flying everywhere. I think we're about to see some East African dancers and Vietnamese dancers. I mean, I just love it.
Bring through all of those prejudices and start realizing that we're all part of that human race.
The Sioux City Human Rights Commission hosted the 28th annual gathering. Executive Director Karen Mackey enjoys seeing people here from all walks of life.
People don't think of the Siouxland community as being ethnically diverse, and it certainly is.
Do you think Sioux City embraces cultural diversity, or do you think we still have a long way to go?
Still have a ways to go. You can always get better. But we are getting better and better about embracing our diversity. I think we just need to be inquisitive about other cultures and ask questions. People are always very willing to explain their culture if you just honestly ask questions and it comes from a good place in your heart.
The Multicultural Fair provides Siouxland with the answer to uniting people from different beliefs and backgrounds. For Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
And that was Sheila Brummer at the Siouxland Multicultural Fair over the weekend. This is the first week of April, and it is the one-year anniversary of a locally produced music program on Siouxland Public Media. Sheila Brummer sat down with the host of the show for his insights on songs and life.
One of the great things about Siouxland Public Media, the locally produced music shows.
Hit me with the blues now.
Well, hello there. Glad you're tuned in to my program.
Keep it locked right here, all right?
Here we are again, another Moonwalk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Saturday Night Jazz.
There's one in the middle of the week that really brings a lot of people a ton of joy.
Check it out. You're listening to Mixtape Dance Party.
9 o'clock Wednesday nights. Host Earl Herlick put the show together, and Earl joins us now to kind of talk about what inspired you to put the show together.
Well, because I think my initial inspiration came from making mixtapes for my own when I was a kid, when I was a teenager. You know, we had 8-track tapes, we had cassette tapes, we had CDs, you know, anything that I could get my hands on, I would tape my favorite music.
What is your favorite music?
My tastes are very eclectic, you know, they range from anything from punk, you know, like the Ramones. Like Britpop from the mid-90s, the Weezer. Just fun music, you know, just mixtape dance party, you know, danceable music.
And you say such clever things.
Oh.
You can tell you put some thought and time into your show.
Yeah, I try to.
Mixtape dance party, we will be lowering our usual freak flag while hoisting up the good old Union Jack.
My day job is, of course, I'm a reporter for the Sioux City Journal. I work for the Weekender, so writing is kind of what I do, so it just became natural for me to... I treat the show as the same way as I treat, you know, anything else that I write.
Tell us a little bit more about you. You've been at the Sioux City Journal for a dozen years or so.
Yes.
And you grew up in Sioux City. But
I did.
Fill in the blanks about who is Earl Herlick.
Uh-oh. As a kid, I wanted to be a writer, and I also wanted to be in the music field. You know, even though I'm not musical by nature, I've always written about music. That really followed me throughout my childhood. You know, I remember as a teenager going out to King's Court, you know, if you're from Sioux City of a certain age, you remember King's Court as being kind of like a punk scene.
I actually attended shows at King's Court.
Well,
there was a band called Kid Death, fronted by a guy who is called Sioux City Pete, Peter Phillips.
Yes,
so if you know
yes,
who,
yes, I
if
do.
You know Pete.
So we may have been there at the same time.
Yeah, you never know. I know. And it's just crazy how time just kind of flies by, and these songs that we used to grow up with are now back in again because you can
they
hear
are.
Them and you brought them back to life with your radio show.
They are, because things that we thought, you know, were going to be disposable, but they're now they're classics, you know, and we listen to them with a new set of ears, you know. What was just, you know, kind of fun and quirky, now they're important, you know. Now they're, you know, evergreen type of songs.
Dance all night, play all day, doing nothing to get it.
Songs that kids say, oh, I like that too. So that's cool.
What would be some of those songs?
Okay.
In your mind?
That's a good question, because I do like Weezer. Weezer's always been like a guilty pleasure group of mine, because I've been following them practically since day one. I love the Pinkerton era Weezer, and I'm one of those strange people who like their new stuff as well.
What are some of the new artists you really enjoy?
Well, one of the important aspects about Mixtape Dance Party is I try to stay current, you know. I try to break new artists on the show, and I've been noticing that there's a lot of new groups from Europe, or a lot of new groups from Australia, which is strange. I've been playing a lot of Mall Rat, which is an Australian girl.
I'm sorry about your broken heart. I'm trying to walk on broken glass.
new band. They have such a strange mid-name. They're called Rolling Blackouts Coastal Fever, which is like the weirdest name ever.
Where space originates.
Seems you always have the bands in history that have unusual names and that kind of thing. And what's great about your show is you never know what you're going to hear. Sometimes you kind of have a theme, it seems like, but you just never know what's going to come up next, which is awesome. It's cool. It's eclectic.
Well, because I want that. I want people to actually have to listen for the entire hour, because I try to go from genre to genre. It's not very specific to one particular type of music, so I try to keep people on their toes.
And it's been a year.
It has been a year.
Since you've been doing that show, since you first launched it here at Siouxland Public Media.
Yeah.
And you also work as a part-time announcer, too. We can hear you on weekends.
Yes,
and
can.
Other shifts as well.
Absolutely.
You have to be super busy. How do you do it all?
I don't do anything well. I mean, well, this is actually fun. And one of the best compliments that I've gotten so far is, you know, people know the newspaper me, which is more serious. But when they hear the radio me, the mixtape dance party me, they think, oh, you sound like you're having the time of your life. And in fact, I am. And that keeps it fresh. You know, it doesn't seem like a year. It just seems like a couple of months. But, you know, I've been doing this for a while.
That's true. Going back to your day job as a journalist for the Sioux City Journal, looking back, I know I asked you your favorite song and your favorite groups. What would be the most memorable story you ever put together for the Sioux City Journal?
Well, that's a tough one because I'm a features writer, mm-hmm. so I don't cover like the murders or the fires. You know,
you get to do the fun things.
I do. So I've been able to talk with kids. I've been able to talk with older people. I've talked with musicians. You know, I've done many interviews with like the Langleys, Mike and Jack Langley.
I was a teenage baby pterodactyl singing a song from the future.
One of my favorite stories that I've ever written, he just passed away a couple of weeks ago. His name was Pinky Catron. He was kind of a pool shark. He was a pool shark at the senior center, and you'd probably see him at like at the farmer's market because he was also kind of a musician of sorts.
Jesus, keep me from all harm.
But he was just so quirky and just so weird, you know, that you were drawn to him, and I always wanted to hear what he was doing in it, and he was either entertaining, you know, with his guitar and singing, or making money as a pool shark, or hitting on old ladies at the senior center. So it was great.
Yeah, no. Well, Earl, it has been a pleasure having you sit here and tell us Mixtape Dance Party and a little bit about the inside of your life, too. I just think that the show, everyone needs to listen to the show, because you said you like quirky people. I think you kind of bring that part of your personality out on that show as well. I think that would be right. Right?
I think
hopefully that's a compliment.
It is. It totally
right.
is. Thank
well,
you.
Earl Herlick, thank you so much for talking to us. Any future goals for Mixtape Dance Party?
Just keep on plugging away, I guess. Check it out. You're listening to Mixtape Dance Party from Siouxland Public Media. My name is Earl Herlick, and when I was younger, I was one of those guys.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. On Thursday, March 28th, the Sioux City Community Theater dedicated a new theater in memory of a longtime Sioux City broadcaster. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer was there and filed this story.
That's not what we do. That's not how this works.
The curtain opened on the first production at the Tom Peterson Black Box Theater, a comedy called Here We Sit.
It's unbearable.
I may scream.
It's craziness with actors portraying the audience and some audience portraying actors.
Rick Myers is the director of the show and president of the Sioux City Community Theater Board. He was also friends with Peterson, who died in a wintry traffic accident on January 2nd, 1994, at the age of 45.
You might be more in the rain and snow area than
like,
you see.
What? No, I don't believe you. And it took a long time for that to really sink in to the people that really knew him, that he was gone.
Before the actors hit the stage, an official dedication.
This all started with a very tragic situation and our loss of Tom.
For the project, more than 2 years in the making. The theater named for the former KCAU weather director, well known for his unique way of giving the forecast.
This is the Major 9 News Nightcast.
I remember watching the weather on KCAU, and people would send him these outrageous, funny pointers, and of course he loved it, and that was so much of Tom's personality.
Gretchen Gondek, the former general manager for Siouxland Public Media, first met Peterson 40 years ago. Peterson started his career as a disc jockey before appearing in front of the camera.
I went to some media function and met Tom Peterson, who was so welcoming and gave me a big hug and introduced me to a whole bunch of people because I didn't know anybody here. So Tom has always had a very special place in my heart. So it makes this evening all that more special.
Gondek organized the gathering for friends, colleagues, family.
Because he just loved this place.
Including Peterson's sister, Robbie Adelman, who lives in Des Moines.
He had this larger-than-life personality that he showed on TV. Was he really like that in real life?
Yes, very definitely. Yeah, he had fun. He really, I mean, he had down times. Everybody has down times, but he didn't have that many of them. And he could always find something positive in a situation.
Mm-hmm. Adelman says her brother also dedicated his early adult years to another calling.
He graduated from Central High School. And then he went to morning psych college. But that was the time that we were right in the midst of Vietnam. And you had to enlist or you got drafted. And he enlisted for Armed Forces Radio and TV story. And he knew it was factually correct. And he'd take the story in. And by the time they put it on the air, the story would be different. They didn't want the public to know what was really going on over there. So those were really difficult years. Those were difficult years for anybody that had any family member that was in Vietnam. And he was always going to go back, and he never made it back there.
Theater meant a lot to Peterson, who also served as the general manager of the Sioux City Community Theater at the time of his death.
He would be out here doing the pre-show, and then he would rush to work to do the weather.
It's great, and it's really
sometimes just in the nick of time as they were going on, but he was always out here. He was always dedicated to this place. He always took pride in knowing the people and the patrons as they walked in the door.
Cross that bridge when it comes to us.
The new Black Box Theater seats up to 100 people and will showcase more experimental plays and performances.
What do you think Tom would have thought about this theater named in his honor?
I think he'd really be tickled.
Great honor for him. It really is. And I'm sure he's here to see it.
He'd be the first one to say, well, let's just have a beer and celebrate.
Even though it's been more than 25 years since his passing, the Tom Peterson Black Box Theater brings a lasting legacy to a new generation of fans.
It's been a lot of fun over the last few years.
For Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
I walked alone. Now the streets are calling.
The play was Here We Sit. It ended its run April 1st at the Black Box Theater inside the Sioux City Community Theater. Sheila interned at KCAU and says that the highlight of her time there was meeting Tom Peterson and even getting a chance to see his pointer room in the basement of his home in Sioux City. April 15th through the 20th is Worldwide Genocide Awareness Week, when we remember victims of atrocities, including the Holocaust. In Siouxland, fifth grade student Ruby had a chance to interview Holocaust survivor Inga Auerbacher about her experiences during that time and how she's built a life since then. Here's Ruby.
My name is Ruby, and I am in fifth grade. I had the opportunity to have an interview with Inga Auerbacher, Holocaust survivor and author of I Am a Star and many other books. I am proud to present to you my conversation with Inga.
I was just wondering, in your book, with the poem Walls, there is a picture, and I was wondering if you drew that?
No, none of the pictures I drew. A friend of mine saw my poems, and since we didn't have pictures for my poems, because nobody had a camera, nobody was allowed a camera, so he saw what I was writing, and he felt the feeling of those poems. And he drew the pictures for me. He happened to be also a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto just when it started to open. So he felt exactly the scenes in his soul, you see. So he was the one who drew the pictures for me.
Oh, wow.
His name was Israel Birnbaum. He died some years ago. A very good friend of mine.
So do you ever like to try to draw the pictures of your past experiences?
No, I'm not a good artist, no. You know what I say? I paint with words.
That's a good way to word it. And I was also wondering, when did you decide to write your book?
Okay, that's quite a few years ago. I always had in mind that I want to write about my life. I didn't know how to begin. I was working and, you know, very busy. And how do you start to write a book? And I had a friend, a very good friend of mine, a professor. He said, well, just take a piece of paper and a pencil or a pen and start.
Have you written any more poems that actually got turned into songs?
Oh, yeah, many, many.
Really?
More than a dozen. In fact, I have one now that was even sung at the United Nations for International Holocaust Day and Memorial.
In your book, you said that it is our responsibility to be watchful of our leaders and government. So do you think that we are doing a good job as a society to make this happen?
I don't think we are. We have not learned enough. Not only in government, it's all in all of life. One has choices in life, to stay a good person or to follow terrible people who will bring you down in life later on. You have to follow the good things, you know, not just because it's very popular. You don't do just things because they pop up, which can lead you to a very bad situation. Bad things. You make good choices. That's my most important message, is to make good choices.
So you're saying to be a leader, to lead people to do good things. And I also heard a quote, be a donut in a field of bagels. So what it means is that, like, a donut can, like, be the leader and be someone who's colorful and happy all the time and, like, following the rules, and maybe all the bagels aren't, or they're bullying people, and the donut's trying to make a difference.
That's right. You can stand out and make the difference for good, for good, for every child to grow up in peace, without hunger and prejudice.
Yeah, that's a good wish. That's a really good.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I said at the United Nations, and I added to that, no more genocides, no more Holocaust, and no more anti-Semitism. Those were my words at the end of my talk, you know, that went through the world, you know, standing from the podium at the United Nations.
This is my last question for you. And
yes.
I would like to know, what is a piece of advice that you would give to all kids around the world?
I think you should follow your dream no matter how hard it is. Study hard. Go to school. I lost 8 years of schooling in my life. And I tried to pick up. And then I picked a very tough subject. I became a chemist. And I hardly had any math before. It was really, really hard. The only school I really finished after all this happened, after losing 8 years of school, was high school, which I finished in 3 years instead of four. I went to summer school. And then college, because I was sick a lot after the war. And that was took a lot of years away from my life. My message, try to be a decent human being. Don't be a bully. Don't just follow the leader who will maybe lead you to really, really bad things. The main thing is make good choices. That's my main wish. And be tolerant of other people. I believe that most people are good at heart. Just like Anne Frank said, and look at the good of the people. Don't generalize.
That is a very good message. I love that message.
Thank you. And when you don't know a person, you know, you generalize. All so-and-so group are bad. And then you find out, hey, I have a friend, and they are really nice people. And you have to get to know other people. Go to somebody else's church. Eat their food. Make friends. That is so important.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
You're welcome. And I wish you lots of luck. And whatever your dreams you have, pursue them. And life is a wonderful journey. And you're just at the beginning of it. And make, you know, use of it, and to be good to other people, and I think your life will be a lot better. To meet a lot of people and learn to accept them and find out that we all belong to one family.
Thank
hopefully.
You very much.
Thank
for,
you.
Yeah, thank you
okay.
so much
You're
for
welcome.
Talking to me.
Yes, thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you. Good luck to you, too.
That was Ruby, a fifth-grade student from Sacred Heart School in Sioux City, interviewing Holocaust survivor Inga Auerbacher. Worldwide Genocide Awareness Week begins April 15th. And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.